You're listening to Clinical Conversations, a JournalWatch podcast. It's for the week ending October 9, and it's podcast number 60. Joe Elia here. Guess what? The deadline for taking the survey has been extended. The more responses, the merrier, and so there's still a $5 gift certificate for those who do take it. And to do so, go to podcasts.jwatch.org. for further details. Thank you. This time, we talk with Dr. Gary Foster, first author on a study of how weight loss benefits sleep apnea in type 2 diabetes. First, though, a look at the week's principal clinical news stories. The CDC officially released the dosing schedule for the 2009 H1N1 vaccine in MMWR, and kids under 10 will be getting two shots, and the rest of us just one. There are four different manufacturers with slightly different age ranges for their formulations, so be sure to visit our website for a link to the MMWR article. The website is podcasts.jwatch.org. You probably already knew this, but about one-third of people with chronic back pain completely recover within a year. However, at risk for continued pain are those with previous sick leave related to back pain, those having a high disability level at first visit, and those with a higher perceived risk for persistent pain. The details are in a BMJ article. Finally, in the week's news, the FDA has approved an intrauterine device for heavy menstrual bleeding. The device is already used for contraception, and this is an expanded indication for women who use intrauterine contraception. If you think we've missed an important story this week, please let me know. Now, on to the interview. You're listening to Clinical Conversations. The September 28th edition of Archives of Internal Medicine has an encouraging study on the effects of weight loss on sleep apnea. A large study randomized 250 patients with type 2 diabetes and an average BMI of 36 to either usual diabetes support and education or to an intensive lifestyle intervention designed to promote weight loss. After a year, sleep apnea worsened in the usual care group, but it improved markedly among those getting the intervention. Here to discuss the work is Dr. Gary Foster, the study's first author. Dr. Foster is professor of medicine and public health and director of the Center for Obesity Research and Education at Temple University in Philadelphia. Welcome, Dr. Foster.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I wanted to ask right off why you undertook the study. What were you looking for?
Well, about 5 or 6 years ago, a patient came to me for weight loss, presenting for weight loss, and indicated that the physician treating his sleep apnea had indicated that weight loss would be good for his sleep apnea. So I asked the patient, what did you expect in terms of improvement? Did you expect to be able to not be on CPAP, to get off CPAP? Did your doc give you any idea? And the patient said no, so I went to the literature and found that there really had been no randomized trials assessing whether weight loss compared to no weight loss made a difference. So the clinical lore, and in fact many policy recommendations, say weight loss is a good idea in terms of improving sleep apnea for obese patients who have sleep apnea, but no studies had been done. So that's the motivation for doing the study.
I see. So you were trying then to get a baseline of data under that recommendation, then?
Right. I think it's important for both patients and physicians to know, is there a good empirical basis for this clinical recommendation to lose weight if you have sleep apnea? Now, clearly, weight loss has lots of proven improvements in dyslipidemia, glycemic control, hypertension, but there had been no randomized controlled trials on the effects of weight loss on sleep apnea.
The initial apnea-hypopnea index and the magnitude of weight loss were the strongest predictors of the change in that index at 1 year. Does that mean that only the sickest benefit substantially?
I think it's a little hard to tell at this point because this is the only large study that's been conducted, but based on those data, you're correct that if you start out with a higher AHI, let's say, and this makes some common sense, right? If you start out with an AHI of 40 versus an AHI of 20, sort of the higher you start, the more decrease you could expect. And that happens in everything. It happens in weight loss. It happens with blood pressure. Happens with A1C. So that finding isn't so surprising. Mm-hmm. The other one, that the more the weight loss, the greater improvement in AHI, in some ways isn't surprising either. If you believe that obesity is a primary risk factor for obstructive sleep apnea, which it is, then you would expect as you decrease that excess body fat or adiposity that the sleep apnea would get better. The reason I hesitate a little bit is that this study was done on patients who already had pretty severe apnea. So we just don't know if the results would hold up or be different in people with more mild forms of sleep apnea. So, for example, it may be in folks who didn't have diabetes, had more mild apnea, and were younger, that they actually, all of their sleep apnea remits. We just don't know. So that's why I hesitate a little bit about does it mean this or that.
Yeah, I understand. Even a small amount of difference, even though it may not be statistically significant, might make a difference to the patient, though. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it's important to underscore that a little bit of weight loss goes a long way in terms of basically most medical conditions that obese patients have, the primary ones being dyslipidemia, hypertension, and type 2 diabetes. When it comes to sleep apnea, the same principle applies. Some is better than none, and I think a lot of patients mistakenly think, look, if I'm not going to lose 50 pounds, I might as well not do anything, and quite the opposite is true. Not only will your sleep apnea improve, it turns out, but all these other risk factors for disease and actually indicators of disease, that the data for which are much more bountiful at this point than they are for sleep apnea. So the clinical take-home is don't adopt a threshold mentality for weight loss. There's no magical number above which you get, you know, up to that number you get nothing, and at that number you get the benefits. It tends to be relatively linear.
Okay. The people who were on usual care, the people who maintained their entry weight even, or those who did maintain an entry weight, suffered an increase in the apnea-hypopnea index. What's the implication of that, do you think?
It's a scary finding in some ways. What it says is people who not only were weight stable, but they actually lost a pound or so, about 1% of their body weight over the year period, that they actually, at the end of that year, had 6 more events per hour, which was statistically significant over that one-year period. So what it says, at least based on these data, and we're now collecting follow-up data at 4 years to see if the trend holds up, is maybe obstructive sleep apnea has a natural progression of disease that we hadn't quite anticipated in terms of its rate. So if just at 1 year, and again, as you said, this isn't weight gain, this is weight stability, if sleep apnea gets worse by doing nothing, again, I think physicians and their patients need to know that.
So that was probably a surprise then.
A very big surprise, and I think one that should give us some pause about how serious. I think it's clear that how serious obstructive sleep apnea is, but these data would suggest that its rate of natural progression is quicker than we had originally thought.
There's going to be a 4-year assessment, as you said. What are you looking for? What would you hope, that there's persistence of that improvement in sleep apnea?
Well, I think what we're interested in is that, as people know, obesity is a chronic refractory condition. So it wouldn't be unusual if some of the people who had lost weight at 1 year had started to regain. So we're interested in the effect that's obtained in 1 year. Does that persist? But also, how does it vary? If you regain a third of your weight, let's say, do you still have the benefits on sleep apnea? If you maintain all of your weight, do you maintain the same benefits? If you lose additional weight, what exactly happens? So this will be the longest study of intentional weight loss and sleep apnea ever conducted. So we're really excited not just to look at the point in time at 4 years about what happened, but we'll also have 2-year measurements. We've just published our 1-year measurements. So we'll be able to follow the trajectory. If your weight goes up, your weight goes down, what happens to your sleep apnea?
So while we're waiting for those 2- and 4-year results, Dr. Foster, what might clinicians do that they weren't doing before your study came out?
I think 2 things, and one they were probably already doing. But one is to be aware that among obese patients with type 2 diabetes, many of whom are asymptomatic, that our previous study published in Diabetes Care earlier this year suggested that 86% of those patients have obstructive sleep apnea and don't know it. So because it's undiagnosed, it's therefore untreated, and I think that's a serious public health problem. What this current study published a few weeks ago now suggests is that a little bit of weight loss goes a long way. So I think there's additional motivation for physicians who are probably already encouraging their patients to lose weight for other reasons to now encourage them to lose weight because their sleep apnea will be improved.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Dr. Foster, for your time with us today.
My pleasure.
Remember that survey at podcasts.jwatch.org. There's a $5 gift certificate in it for you if you do. You can reach Clinical Conversations at 1-617-440-4374, or you can write to me, jelia@nejm.org. Earlier podcasts are all available at podcasts.jwatch.org, where links for all stories can also be found. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Adore Yano. I'm Joe Elia. Join us next time. Enough said.